I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Welcome to Sick Boy, a podcast where we talk about what it's like to be sick. This week's guest is Emmy. She struggled with her mental health, was in the foster care system, and experienced homelessness. Let's talk about it. Yeah, guys, we got a lot to talk about today. We're hanging out with Emmy. And Emmy, I mean, I'm going to throw it to you to introduce yourself, but you're many things. You wear many hats. You're a writer, you're a speaker, you're an advocate for young folks. You're the author of a book that recently came out called Acceptance, which is a memoir of your journey through the foster care and system and through experiencing homelessness. We're really excited to sit down and chat with you about your very wild story of a young woman growing up, a coming of age tale that is, full of challenges, it sounds like. But before we get into it, I'll throw it to you. Please give yourself a moment to introduce yourself to our listeners.
Thank you so much for having me. And Jeremy, I don't know how I'm going to follow that.
I just read all that through ChatGPT, so I hope that was correct.
Oh, darn, but that's what I did too.
Oh no, this is what the world of AI looks like. Everybody just says the same thing.
Wait, did you do that for your entire memoir too?
Yeah, that's right.
Unfortunately, it was a little early, but the sequel is definitely going to be AI written. Yeah. So my name is Emmy Niedfeld, and I am from Minnesota down in the United States. And I am an author and a journalist, writing a lot about mental health and the teen mental health system. And I'm so happy to be here with you all today.
Yeah.
We're excited to have you here.
Yeah, totally. I think one good place for us to kind of start here, just to give us and our listeners a bit of context into who you are and maybe even like context into what Acceptance is all about. I was wondering if you could give us like a little sort of elevator pitch of your upbringing, because it's really fascinating. I mean, I'm sitting here with like notes in front of me that actually wasn't written by ChatGPT, but, one of the first things that comes up, in the notes that I have here was that you were raised by a mother who was very charismatic, but also a hoarder. And there was like a little bit of wrongdoing on your mother's part by assuming that antipsychotics were like a good way to treat you, who I'm guessing was not going through any kind of psychotic break. What was your upbringing? Give us a little bit of that background.
So I grew up conservative Christian in Minnesota, like very evangelical. And then when I was about 9 years old, my parents separated and they had like so many people, this bitter custody battle, which ended up with my mom getting custody. And as you mentioned, she was a compulsive shopper and she struggled with hoarding. And I think she really had my best interest in mind when she brought me to the therapist and was like, I think she has ADD. Like my daughter's disorganized. She's chronically late. And I was also like 11 years old. And so I was given medication. I went through all this therapy, I did become depressed. I developed an eating disorder. I was really, really struggling because we lived in a house where there were mice everywhere, just screaming on glue traps. And we didn't have any like solid surfaces to like cook or really eat besides our beds and the toilet, And and so that was really the beginning where it all started.
Did you have any siblings or were you an only child?
Well, I have an older half brother, but he was 12 years older than me. And when I was growing up, my mom, she always called me, she's like, you are the prototype of an only child. So I like grew up raised with this idea that I was an only child, even though I had a brother, which is something that comes up in the book because people would read it and be like, where's your brother? Like, yeah. You know,
what are some of the, I feel like hoarding is a term that sort of the way that people have come to use terms like OCD or something like that, where it becomes colloquially used as sort of like a flippant term to describe like, oh, I've got a lot of stuff. I know that it's much different from that. Like what are some of the things about living in a house with somebody who is hoarding that, that you know, the average person is not going to, you know, think about what that experience might be like.
Like how is hoarding different from the back of Brian's car?
Which is filled with garbage.
Not anymore, guys. Before I started going to therapy, it was like that.
Now it's a little cleaner. Yeah.
I mean, I would say hoarding is definitely a spectrum, right? Where there's Brian, the back of Brian's car.
He's
on
it.
Side.
So he's on the spectrum. Got it.
A few years ago. Yeah.
I'm not trying to diagnose you, right? But therapy works. And then on the other side, you know, you have people where they acquire so much stuff that it literally kills them.
Hmm.
And actually, when I was growing up, it was the early 2000s. And this word hoarding, it didn't really exist in the common vocabulary. Mm-hmm. Like that television show Hoarders, it had not come out yet.
Right.
And so when I was at the therapist's office and I was trying to explain what was happening at home, people were like, yeah, your mom has a lot of stuff, like no big deal. And I think that's often what people still think about when they think about hoarding.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly like everyone hoards differently than others. But like in my house, it was the type of thing where we couldn't get to the kitchen sink because there were like piles of stuff in front of it. And like food would start to rot in part because it would just get lost.
Mm.
You know, like at one point a family member, I'm going to reveal that I'm American here with this anecdote, but at one point a family member like told me like, we should get your mom a gun. Like she's a single woman who lives on her own. She needs a firearm. And I was like, she's going to lose it. Like it's just going to fall into a pile and then she's going to accidentally like shoot herself.
Right. Yeah.
Whoa.
And so I think people, it can be really hard to like kind of visualize this house where there's only like a thin snaking pile. There's like mice running between it. There's like excrement everywhere and just how damaging that can be on somebody's health.
For the person and for anybody who's living in the, I mean, especially a child who's trying to make sense of the world and living in this space.
Right. Yeah. And that's what I was curious about asking. Like when your mom took you to the doctor about your mental health at a young age, was that a result of the environment that you were in? Like what, can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Personally, I think part of it was projecting, you know, that clearly something was wrong, but like many other conditions, a big part of hoarding can often be not realizing that it's a problem or not being able to see like, okay, I have an issue, you know? And even to this day, if you ask my mom, she'd say, I have a lot of stuff, but it's not dirty. You know, it doesn't hurt me. You know, and also like when families get divorced, I think we often have this idea like, okay, the best thing to do for children is to take them to therapy without. And I think therapy can be absolutely wonderful. It can be helpful and life changing. And also it can be medicalizing, right? Mm. And it can take normal problems and then apply antipsychotics.
I'm really curious about that because I went through a really challenging divorce. My parents separated when I was 15 years old. And like up until that point in my life, I like had this like, not like perfect childhood upbringing, but like a really great like middle class upbringing. My parents didn't spoil me, but like we were able to like be involved in sports and do things like that. And both my parents were there. And so it was like really great until all of a sudden this divorce happened. And for me, it like flipped my world upside down. I could have never imagined that my parents were going to separate. And on top of that, it was a really nasty divorce that went on for like almost 10 years. And I remember my parents asked me, like in the very beginning of it, if I would be interested in going to therapy and talking to someone about it. I don't think they said therapy. I think they were like, would you be interested in talking to someone about it? And I was like, no, I'm okay. I'm good. And I think for a long part of my life, I told myself that it was totally fine. And I didn't really understand the ways that it impacted me and my relationships. And I, like I mentioned earlier, I started going to therapy, which was a couple years ago. And going into therapy, especially after having the benefit of having a lot of conversations through this podcast about mental health, I felt like I was way more adequately prepared to sort of go into the recesses of my mind and those past traumas and explore them. But I also think at the same time that if I tried to do that when I was 15, I could easily see how that would have fucked me up a lot more. And I'm curious, like, what you think about, you know, children going to therapy and the preparation that it takes to be able to do that at that age, or what that should be like, and like in contrast to an adult experiencing therapy.
Well, I'm really sorry you went through that. I think divorce is not something we like, the painful parts are not something we talk about enough.
Mm-hmm. Especially because of how common it is. Like it's sort of just like, because, you know, like the stat is or whatever, 50% of marriages end in divorce now. So people are like, well, you, like your parents are divorced. I mean, that happens or whatever. And it can be really tough.
Yeah. And I think there's a fundamental difference too when you have someone voluntarily choosing to go to seek help versus when it's foisted on people. Mm. And, you know, lots of kids can decide like, hey, I do want to talk to somebody. And there's also a power imbalance that means that like when I was in therapy, I did not want to be there. I did not think it was going to be helpful. And people were constantly asking me like, you know, you have this trauma that's unresolved. Like you need to go into it. You need to explore it. And I just wasn't ready. And I knew I wasn't ready. And I knew like, this isn't a good idea. And so like for me, and I think for a lot of teens, it's like, sometimes you just have to stabilize and you have to get to a place in your life where you're like, okay, I'm out of that bad situation. And like, I feel safe enough to look back.
It's a really interesting it's a really interesting topic that I don't know if we've ever really touched on, is kind of talking about like how, because we often and exclusively talk about therapy in this, like in the sense of how helpful it can be, we don't really ever really look at the sort of negative impact that it could have if it's not necessary. The same way that like, you shouldn't take antibiotics if you don't have something that the antibiotics is fighting, because it can mess up your ability for antibiotics to be useful in the future, because it won't be able to fight, or you could develop resistance and that sort of thing. So like, it's just an interesting angle that I've never really thought about.
Yeah. Just to interject on that, like my opinion is that like when you said, therapy when it's not necessary, I feel like therapy,
or when you're not ready.
Right. Yeah. I think that's a better way to put it, because I think therapy can always be amazing if it's presented and packaged in the right way. If you're not going there to like, you know, be treated because you're like, quote unquote, treated because you're sick. And if it's there to like help you proactively manage your mental health and stay on top of things, then I think everybody should go to therapy when they're ready.
Sort of preface this next question and maybe a lot of questions with just the fact that whenever we're talking to somebody who's written a book that has like all the juicy details, we want to be, you know, aware that we're not drawing out the story that makes the book unnecessary to read. So I'm going to preface it with that. What happens with you ending up in the foster care system in Minnesota?
So when I was 13, I went to an inpatient psych ward. And I had become really, really depressed. I had taken a lot of different drugs by that point, and like each different medication made me feel like more hopeless that something was actually going to help me. So I went to the hospital and it was actually amazing. I loved it there. It was so clean and they had hot water. They had hot food. It was amazing. And I basically went back like multiple times that year. And eventually I I got a county social worker. One doctor was like, I think that your mom is causing problems, and referred my case to Hennepin County, which was the county where I lived. And then I was hospitalized yet again. And then I was sent to this residential treatment facility. And for a while they, you know, they wanted me to go to foster care before the treatment center, but there were, you know, it wasn't going to work out. I was like not a candidate. And there's a huge shortage of homes, especially for teenagers, mm-hmm. and especially for teenagers with like serious needs. And so instead I went to this like locked treatment facility, which is kind of similar to these troubled teen facilities that are in the news. Except it wasn't for profit, but a lot of the practices were the same, where it was like super punitive. Mm. And then after that, I went into foster care. I was there for a year. And it was, my mom voluntarily agreed to let me go. But it was pretty clear that to me that if she hadn't agreed, that then they would have like done a report to like the authorities, and it would have been like involuntary.
Right. How old were you then?
I was 14.
Right.
Man.
That's it. Did you like immediately get set up with a foster care family once that happened?
Well, so that's a great question. And my hunch is that before I went to the treatment center, that my social worker was looking, like she told my doctor, she told everybody like, okay, we're going to try foster care. And that at that time she just couldn't find anything. And that like, I was in this treatment facility for 9 months. And so basically by the end of 9 months, there was a family. And I don't know if, and you know, I was told like, there's no other families, like, this is it. Like, if you don't want to go live with them, you're going to stay locked up for your sophomore year, your 10th grade of high school. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there just aren't that many out there.
At that time in your life, when you're going to school, like, do you go to school in person and then come back to the hospital, or how does that
work? That's a great question. So basically they had, two classrooms where they had teachers from the special education department of the local school district. So there was one teacher who was like math science. The other teacher was like English history. And it was a lot of like multiplication worksheets, read alouds, that kind of stuff.
Right. Is it like, do you feel like it's a relatively like a good learning environment? Like there's one teacher and there's a few students, or is it just like, hey, there's so much bad shit going on right now that this is just like learning on top of this is just so hard?
I would have loved to go to school because for me, like, school is the escape. Studying is like my favorite thing to do. But it was really a joke. And I think it was hard for me because I was like, I want to be achieving. But I think it was even worse for a lot of the other patients who were there because they did need remedial help.
Yeah.
And going to like inpatient therapy or having these family problems, like, it makes it hard to learn. And so I felt we should have had even more like academic attention than we did.
Mm-hmm. I'm really curious about like going into a foster home at that age. I've already mentioned that when I was 15, I went through this pretty challenging divorce. And I remember at times like fighting with my parents and them saying like, here's the fucking phone. Like call, like you want child services to come pick you up? Call them, like call them and see what happens and where you end up. And like, I remember having this debate in my head of like, the situation at home is really bad, but what would foster care be like? And I remember this like sort of idea that like, there's this like fear of what that system might be like. Were you afraid going into the foster care system, or was it like a sort of, how did you feel?
Did you ever watch the show Atlanta?
No.
There's a singular episode in season 3 where this young girl is in an argument with her mother, just like what you're talking about. And the mother basically says exactly that. Like, I don't give a fuck. Like, call child services. See what happens. And so she does. And she ends up getting taken out of her home and put into a foster care family. And she's this young, like, black child. And she gets set up with this, like, sort of, like, hippy-dippy white family that, like, you know, like drink their own urine kind of like vibes, you know, like really
very hippy dippy.
And of course, you know, by the end of the episode, she escapes from the family.
gets back to her mom, and her mom's like, "Welcome home. Like, how was your experience?" And, mm-hmm. and it was like, the lesson learned was like, "Fuck, like I, you know, things aren't great here at home, but they're most certainly not nearly as fucking bad as they could be with a family that you don't have the
like Matilda
to join.
Like,
yeah,
like totally, the plot yeah. to Matilda, right? Yeah. And yeah. so like it's yeah. so common in media to see like the foster care yeah. system portrayed as like this like scary place.
I didn't mean to cut you off there, but yeah. it you just it, something you said there, Bri, reminded me of that.
Who knew that this was a trope? Because yeah. when I was younger, my mom would say the same things. Like, yeah. I would say, you know, we don't have hot water. And she'd be like, okay, like, you want to go live with some other family where you get molested? Like, and so I had been really afraid of it and afraid that it was the worst thing that could possibly happen to me. But I had, I think as far as experiences go, my experience was relatively good. I was placed with one family and they had a relative living with them, which is very common. So she was like their other foster daughter, but she was related. And I lived in the same place for the whole school year. But it absolutely was not easy. And there was a huge culture shock. Because even though my family had been religious, my mom, she loved art. She was super intellectual. And this foster family like thought Emmy is miserable because she studies too much. Like that right. is her number one problem in life.
Mm-hmm. And like for you, that was, as you mentioned, that was like your escape, like immersing yourself in learning.
Yeah, exactly. So that's not a great fit.
Yeah. and they were, from what I gathered, like they were extremely religious, correct?
Yeah. I'd say for Minnesota, probably moderate.
Okay,
but,
sure.
Like we had a fight over my art history flashcards. I took an art history class while I was living with them, and we had to like cut out little pictures of famous statues and put them on cards. And they were really upset that the statues were naked.
Mm. How does that, I saw that you wrote that, and I really just tried to think about what that situation looks like in terms of like how the back and forth goes, because it's so outside of my experience that I'm like, whoa, how does that logically come to pass? Like that yeah. interaction, when that gets brought up to you, that is offensive or wrong or however it's framed, I'm not exactly sure. How do you respond to that in a way that isn't offensive by saying like what? Like really? What do you mean? Like how does that conversation play out?
Yeah. Well, they had a set of like brown leather side-by-side recliners where mm-hmm. they would like sit when they were home. And so mm-hmm. they would like call me down for like the big like talking to you and be like, you know, why are you bringing porn into our house? Mm. Like this is pornographic. And you know, and I was like, it's Michelangelo's David. Like it's a famous work of art, you know. I don't understand why he's naked either, right?
And you like, know? Is that not at the Vatican?
guys, that's Catholic. I'm sorry, yeah. but like, sure, in right, Minnesota, right. like Catholic My is bad. Not Christian. It is right. very different, and you're burning yeah. in hell if you believe in the Virgin Mary.
Right. Okay? See, outside of my experience, I'm outside of my area of expertise.
This is a little bit of an aside, but I went on a work trip to England like 7 or 8 years ago, and I was staying with this, or I was supposed to be staying with this guy from one of the offices there that was like a sister office to the company I worked for. And I ended up not staying with him and ended up getting a hotel room, but I went for dinner with him. And while I was at dinner, he was like, I'd really love for you to come by my place. And I was like, this is feeling a little bit weird. And he's like, no, seriously, I want to show you something. And I'm like, this is making it more weird for me now. And he's like, I've got a life-size statue of David in my backyard. And I was like, I'm really not interested. But then also I was I kind of got to see it.
Running over.
So I went and looked in I was like, hey, my hotel is actually just past your place. So like, we'll take a cab, we'll go by, I'll look at it, and then I'm going to leave. And so I went and looked, and it was like this, little English street, like from like Coronation Street or something. Like you can totally picture it in your head right now. And there's like a little garden with like a little white picket fence, and like all the houses, it's row houses. They all look the exact same, except this guy's house, which has like a 15 or 20 foot tall statue of David.
Holy shit.
Just in the middle of the yard for no reason.
So yeah. Naughty.
And yeah, that it was
so naughty.
How naughty.
Offensive, really. So how do you respond? Thank you for that aside, Brian. How do you respond to this accusation of pornography?
I mean, I was like, they can feel free to get dressed. Like, I don't know why the sculptures made them naked either. But like, I was like, it's my homework. Like, I have to, you know, I kind of have to do it, you know? And we compromised. Like, I wasn't going to let their other foster daughter, who was like 17 or 18 years old, I wasn't going to let her see them. I was going to keep it from her. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the compromise. Mm.
Wow. Now, was this interaction one of the, so, you know, just to, again, spoiler alert, but even though everybody who's listening to this is going to go out and buy the book, we know that anyway, because that's just like how our podcast rolls. Like, everyone just listens and then they go buy the book. So go buy the book, you'll read the story. But when I know that, like, you end up being kicked out of the house with this foster family that you have. And I'm wondering, like, how much of this interaction about the pornography played a role in you eventually being kicked out?
Well, there were a lot of tensions kind of mounting. And so this was definitely like one interaction that kind of led to it. And another thing is my mom was still like pretty involved in my life.
Right.
And there was a lot of animosity there between her and them, where she would really push their limits. And so after this Michelangelo thing, you know, I went and I talked to my mom, and then we went figure drawing and we went and we drew naked people. And I don't think my foster parents like ever found out, like, this is what you're doing with your mom on like Sunday visits. But pretty soon I was like all up in there, you know, with a sketch pad. So yeah. And so it was like the fight that really like broke the camel's back was I was trying to go to a club at school, what they used to call the Gay Straight Alliance. Mm-hmm. And it was like all the nerds in school, they all went to this club, and we were going to put up posters that said, like, told people don't say gay in terms of like, don't use it as an insult.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, my foster parents didn't want to let me go.
Oh, wow.
And then I told them, well, what if I am gay? You know, and I was like, I don't know what I am. Like, I'm bi, but at the time I was like, I didn't even know that was an option on the menu.
Sure.
And they were really upset, right? Because they felt like I had been withholding important information from them and like putting their other foster daughter at risk.
Man, the hills that people die on, man.
Yeah. It's so interesting that, like, can you provide a little bit more context in terms of like how, like, what is the expectation of foster care? I mean, you're like a 14-year-old kid going into this family. I'm presuming that you stay until like you're 18 if things are working out. So like, why is it normal for a foster family to like want their foster kid to like embody the values of their family? I'm not sure if I like fully understand how that works, or is that just this family in particular?
I think it's got to be really hard to have a teenager living in your house who does not respect you or your values.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, to their credit, you know? And it was also everybody's like first time, right? It was my first time being in a foster home, and you know, they had a kinship placement already, but it's a little different, right? Yeah. When it's somebody that you already know, who's your family member related to you by blood. And so, yeah, I think I could have, you know, the advice that I got that was probably good advice that I didn't really follow was just like, you know, to try to just like keep my head down as much as possible.
I mean, you have to like respect families who are trying to provide a roof over kids' heads who you know, who really need it. But it's a little bit like, the math doesn't add up in my head of like, hey, you have these values that like are probably not incredibly common, and you're bringing a kid into your family who's been alive for 14 years already that obviously has, you know, influences outside of your family values. So I feel like there's got to be some sort of like balance of like trade off of like, hey, we understand that this kid is going to have their own set of values too, even though we want them to like respect ours.
Yeah. I mean, you're painting the picture of the most ideal person on planet Earth being a foster parent. And I think I have a couple of relatives that are adopted and have experience in the foster care system from two different families. And from my understanding of having conversations with, their parents, their adopted parents, is that there's just a very eclectic type of person there's eclectic type of people that become foster parents. They become foster parents for all types of different reasons. And one reason could be exactly like you said, all they want to do is just provide, a safe space for somebody who has maybe had a lot of trouble in their upbringing. Some people do it because they can get money from the government for it. In the case in Canada, that's an unfortunate type of person that does that. There can be people that feel like they have the opportunity to impose the values that they see as the correct ones onto somebody that maybe they see as misguided or misled or something like that. I mean, there's just people out there that have all sorts of different reasons for being involved in the foster care system. And I think that's might be why that there becomes this trope of the foster care system, because there isn't really a standard of care for foster care as far as what I understand, at least in Canada.
When you eventually are told by your foster family, like, you can't live here anymore, we're not going to do this. You were saying earlier that there was a shortage of families. Mm-hmm. And you don't really get to choose the family that you get to live with. This family decides to like send you out on your own. Is there any conversation with like officials or any sort of like organization that is like there to try to help you find a new family, or is that's it? Like your ticket's punched.
In my case, they were very considerate and they let me wait until the big year of the end of the year tests were happening so that I could stay there, study for finals, take them. And my case was a little unique because I was 15 then, but in my state, there was a program where high school students in their final 2 years could attend university instead of high school, and the state would pay for it. And so I had applied for this program, and I had gotten accepted to attend college really early. And so basically what my social worker and everybody planned out was like, I'm just going to go do that. And because my mom had signed me in to the system voluntarily, she was also able to just like sign me out. And at the time she had a spare apartment. We lived in like a duplex where the top was rented out and then it was vacant. And so I got to go like live there, like basically sleep on the floor for a few weeks and then leave.
And you left in a Toyota Corolla.
Well, not quite. That summer I left for a summer camp. And it was a photography camp that my teacher at school had helped. She'd like inspired me to apply. And it was just this beautiful like place filled with all these nerdy teenage artists wearing like dorky uniforms. And it was like the happiest 6 weeks of my life. And while I was there, they had a boarding school. And so they encouraged me to apply. And I did apply and I got in. And so then I started my last 2 years of high school there.
The thing that really stood out to me in reading through the like a lot of your experiences is your sort of path into applying to universities, and the way that you described whether to kind of pour all of your mental health challenges and experiences into an application, or whether somebody might withhold that information, and why you might be incentivized to do one or the other, and sort of the whole the idea around like resilience and overcoming, which when I was reading through that, I was going, wow, this is super valuable, because it's coming in the era of in the era of talking about mental health in a much more commonly, that mental health conversations are happening much more frequently, and I feel like we're making progress in that direction. There is a lot of emphasis, it seems like, on overcoming, and you sort of highlighted why that can be a problem, or why that isn't always the thing that we want to be hyper focused on, and I'm really interested in that because it's not the angle of the conversation that we have very frequently, and I think it's really when I read that I was like, wow, that's really important.
Yeah. We live in a culture that is obsessed with resilience. It's like the one positive trait that nobody can argue with. Like, you're on a Peloton, they're like, be resilient. Everybody's always telling you, like, overcome your challenges. Mm-hmm. And so when I was applying to college, I was struggling with, okay, how do I talk about this time that I spent in the psych ward, in residential treatment, in foster care? How honest should I be? And this is something that so many high schoolers are experiencing more and more every year as more teens have mental health struggles. And at first, I was completely honest. And my college counselor convinced me that, like, if you tell them that you were, like, seriously ill because of the home that you were in, like, it will help them understand how bad it was. But then I was rejected. That was in the early application cycle, and I got a no, and my high school counselor called them and said that they told her that I wasn't overcoming enough and that they needed to see my success story. And so it became really clear that,
wow,
like, yeah.
At what? 17, 18?
I was like just barely 17 years old, and I had written these applications. I had worked on them while staying on friends' sofas, while sleeping in my car, while staying at a shelter, like, because once I went to boarding school, I didn't really have a place to go during breaks. So I was still like in the middle of it. But the expectation was, you have to show you've triumphed.
That's so fucked up, because isn't one way that you could triumph by them accepting you into college? You know, yeah, it's like,
that's like a piece
this
of the,
could, hey, yeah, like, yeah. I'm asking you, like, this is all the struggles I've been through. Here's how much I've applied myself. I mean,
that's the story, like, of Harry Potter. Like, that's how he started to, you know, become resilient. It was when he got accepted to Hogwarts.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, we're going to have to need to rewrite that for right now. First, he has to become like a champion wizard, and then he gets a shot at Hogwarts, right?
Yeah.
I mean, well, after all the publicity that the Harry Potter series gave Hogwarts, now they're a little bit more, you need to be a champion wizard before you can get accepted.
Let's
now.
Be fair. Harry was a legacy acceptance.
Yeah, you're right. It's because of his family name.
He didn't really do the work.
Favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
After that first experience, did you come back to it with this, like, you know, this drive to write those applications again, but sort of closet yourself as someone who struggled?
I mean, I was pissed. Like when they said, like, you know, that I wasn't an overcomer and that they couldn't see my success story, I was like, I'll show you success, you know? And I think for any teenager, it's really hard to navigate who am I on the inside versus how do I present myself to other people? Mm-hmm. That's like, I mean, that's a fundamental struggle of being human. And that's also like a marker of the adolescent, like, psychosocial development. But, you know, for me getting into college and a college that could give me full scholarship, because it was like, even back then it was $50,000 a year if I at a private university and like $20,000 a year at my local public university. So this was my way out. This was my escape hatch. And so I did, I went back and I rewrote them so that I didn't mention like any mental illness at all. Like not even a little bit of depression, like no, nothing.
Whoa. What did you feel like you learned through that process?
Well, first I felt like a liar, a liar and like a cheater. It was also it ended up being a useful exercise in externalizing my problems. Mm. Because for so many years, I had basically been told by adults and therapists and stuff, like that I was choosing to be sick, that my behavior was the problem, and that, like, you know, even being in foster care, that was my fault because I wasn't like tough enough to handle being at home because I was so troubled. And when I wrote this application where none of that stuff ever happened, it was really like, okay, look, these bad things happened to me and that's why I've struggled.
Mm-hmm. And you're and in this whole process, like there are a number of amazing schools in Canada and the United States, but you're applying to like, you know, some really prestigious top flight schools, like, yeah, like Yale and Harvard and the like.
Exactly. Yeah. Cause there's only in the US, there's like a really small group of colleges that provide full financial aid. Mm. And so it tends to be that the Ivy League schools and some other smaller colleges, but it's really like fewer than 30. Like it's a really small number.
Wow. Really? So is that ultimately playing an influence into, I mean, I'm sure it must be the types of places that you're seeing as like the schools that I can go to by the nature of their scholarship programs, just so happen to be some of the, like the hardest schools to get into. I mean, I don't know, like Harvard's something like 2%.
Yeah.
Acceptance rate or something. Like it's crazy. Yeah, it's like crazy low.
Yeah. Luckily it was a little higher when I was in high school. Otherwise I wouldn't have gotten in.
Like 3%.
I mean, 1% increase on like the hundreds of thousands of applications that they get every year would be a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, and it was a recession. It was 2009. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, that's, kids are going to be going through that again today when they're looking at schools. But yeah, it was really this like driven by desperation.
When you talk about like separating the trauma from like your application, like taking that away from your how you identify as like your sense of self, is that what you mean? Like you mean that like for the first time you realize like, hey, there's all of this bad stuff that like I was originally writing about as things that were part of me that, you know, have built towards some sort of level of resilience that would make me a good applicant for this school program, but then realizing like, actually, I don't need any of this stuff. This stuff doesn't define who I am. And therefore, I can take all of the things that are, you know, actually really great about me and then put them on this application without the bad stuff holding you back.
Wow, that is such a positive spin on it.
That's not the way you were looking at it.
Well, I mean, okay, I think that when I applied, right, when I was going through it, look, I was really struggling, right? I had an eating disorder. I was misusing Adderall, like while I was writing these applications, right? Mm. And so at the time, I really, really felt like a liar. And like I had just cheated my way into college if I was going to get in. But it was really like a few years later, you know, once I was on campus, I realized, okay, there is a different version of the story that is also true, in which, you know, I had a shitty adolescence because these shitty things happened to me and it wasn't my fault.
Mm-hmm. It's like a really gnarly example of fake it till you make it.
Yeah, exactly. It's the Hunger Games of fake it till you make it. Yeah.
Did it, was when you finally got accepted to Hogwarts or sorry, Harvard, did you feel like there was a big shift in your life? You know, like going from writing applications in your Corolla to, you know, like, you know, literally not having like a place to call home to all of a sudden being in this place that, you know, like when I think back to university, for me, my experience at the university was so community driven. Like it being a part of a university, you are a part of this like gigantic family, and it is. I look back on my university days really fondly.
Community driven is the nicest way I've ever heard anybody say going to a party school.
Yeah, well, I mean, hold on. I went to a party school for 1 year. All right, realized that if I wanted to take my life seriously, I had to change it up and went to a non-party school.
There's lots of schools in Nova Scotia that have community driven environments.
Yeah. Yeah. But yes, regardless, if I'm looking back at the party school days, or you know, my time at Ryerson in Toronto, both of those experiences, I look back on now as a 35-year-old man, like. Those were some of the most like special times of my life. I met people that I'll never forget. You know, I was a part of something that was exciting and something that was, you know, driving me to like be the best version of myself. Was that a big part of your experience in terms of like looking at the contrast between where you were before you got accepted to where you were a couple of years into your schooling?
Yeah. Harvard definitely changed my life, and it gave me a lot of stability. And, you know, I had hoped that it would kind of take me out of this really bad situation and just plop me into a totally different world. And it definitely did that. I think at the time I was a little frustrated because it didn't happen right away. It wasn't like I got the admissions letter and then a helicopter came and like, you know, threw down the ladder. That's really like, honestly, that's really what I was hoping for. And it took time to like adjust to like being at college. Right. Mm. And there were moments where I felt just so, so grateful to be there. And like, really, like I'm looking around me at Harvard Yard and the sun is going through the trees and the leaves are golden. And I'm like walking through a dream. And there were other times when I was struggling and I felt like, okay, why am I not grateful? Like I got into Harvard. Now I need to be grateful every minute of every day for the rest of my life. And that was like an unrealistic burden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can relate to that experience quite a bit. I went to a private school that was just outside of Boston. For the last 2 years of high school, I played hockey there and I was on scholarship there. And I went there, and for the first 3 months, 4 months that I was there, I was like, in hindsight, I was very depressed. Like, and I was homesick, and I didn't really, and like exactly like these beautiful campuses, you're like, holy shit, where am I? And then at the same time, I'm like, all I want to do is go to sleep and not go to practice and not really go socialize. Why don't I feel like I'm in the place I am in, you know? I just saw myself in that story you just told. And,
I know that after you graduated Harvard, congratulations, you went on to work with Google, at Google as a software engineer, which is hella neat. And after your work there, after you left, you wrote an essay that I believe was published in the New York Times titled, After Working at Google, I'll Never Let Myself Love a Job Again, which kind of went viral. Can you give us a little bit of insight into what it was like to work at Google? And what was that essay all about? What did you learn from working at a place like that?
I loved working at Google. I actually had a dream last night that I was visiting, and I was back like in the campus, and I was going to all the micro kitchens looking for the snacks, the yeah. free snacks. It really felt like a family to me.
Yeah.
Like I had spent these years trying to get the approval of institutions and like really trying to find the place that I belonged. And Google really felt like that place for me. Unfortunately, tech has some sexism issues, and I got these inappropriate comments from my mentor at work, you know, who would call me like beautiful, gorgeous, my queen, like ask me to introduce him to people who he could date, ideally who looked just like me. And this went on for about a year And eventually I spoke up and I made a HR report, and it really like turned my life inside out. And it showed me that, you know, Google is not a family, like no company is a family, which I think is a disillusionment that a lot of people go through early on in their careers. And it made me just totally rethink, okay, what am I trying to get out of these institutions? Like, what need am I looking for them to fill? And how is my relationship to work and achievement going to be different in the future?
That's such an interesting question to think about. Like, what need does this fill for me? I have this really like personal relationship to that, because like I do this work with Taylor and Jeremy here, but I also work for a tech or data company, and we're on contract with a big company right now. And the amount of like stress work can cause at times, when you feel like you really care about the people and like the idea of what the business is trying to do, but then you feel like you're it's interesting, because when you describe, when you say it's not a family, like it kind of is like a family in the way that sometimes your family doesn't respect your needs and boundaries. Mm-hmm. And even in trying to, I was in a meeting the other day and I started talking about therapy to the people, because I was like, hey, listen, I go to therapy and I am feeling this experience that feels a little bit like I do sometimes when I'm in therapy, and I really need you to respect my boundaries right now. And I said that in a meeting to people, like just because it was like a defense mechanism almost. And they were like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And it's so funny, because I've never thought of like, what needs do I have that are being met here? And why do I do, like, what is this place? Like, it's so crazy, because big business is like almost, I don't know if this is true, but like almost need to exist for like society to exist in the way that it is now. But it takes so much out of people. It's so fucking crazy.
Yeah.
I'm kind of like having this like swirl of thought around this, and like the idea of, I mean, this is kind of this now, I feel like is where my thought is going is kind of we're off on a tangent a little bit, but like, even just thinking about, like any company, when you want it to feel like, I think when people start companies, they want it to feel like that. Like they want it to feel like it's very inviting and it's very warm and like it is a family. And I feel like it can be like and maybe this is kind of off track of like what you were feeling. And obviously that you went through a shitty experience with somebody that was being way too weird. But like when you want something to feel familial, because you want people to feel very comfortable and at ease, and that's somehow, I think that's very like natural. But then at the same time, when I think about if we were to have more employees in our business, for example, like there are always boundaries to what that looks like, because at the end of the day, it isn't a family. And there are and because of that, there are boundaries that boundaries that need to be respected, and I don't know. I kind of think about like how much of a family do you really want your business to be to feel like?
Mm-hmm. But Emmy, like to your point, like what? So when you ask yourself that question about like what needs do I want this to meet? Like what came up for you?
When I was at Google, I had a manager who I really adored. Like I loved him. Like really the word love is the right word. And I kind of thought about him as the parent that I always wanted to have. And that like my goal was I'm going to work really, really hard so that we can just always keep working together. So that as he gets promoted, I can be promoted too. And just that like my whole professional and like personal purpose was to like collaborate with this guy. And he did everything he could for me. Like he was really, this was not my harasser. Like he was an ally. And it was not enough. And it really highlighted to me the way that I have this like emotional vulnerability from my past. And how it could make me really productive. Like, I was super productive at Google, but it could also just emotionally devastate me. Mm-hmm. And so now I'm like, never want to get into another situation like that again. Like, not with an editor, not with like a source. Like, I'm like, I can't go there. That's my boundary, right? And that was, and it was not a good boundary probably for him either, right? Like, if you guys hired somebody else and then they were like, you're my dad's, I'm not sure you'd love that.
I mean, the way that I relate to that is in my experience with, teaching yoga, but more so in like the learning and the learning path of yoga and how you take trainings with somebody and like a particular teacher will resonate with you and you want to learn more from that person. And then what that relationship is often not the same to both people because you are the student who sees the one teacher or the one of a few teachers, but often one, and you are the one of many of the students, and you might have a friendship with that person, but the way that is, it can oftentimes be like a lopsided relationship that if you feel kind of like that is your only kind of like tether to this experience, and if that tether were to break for some reason, whether because they stop teaching or they do something else or whatever might do that like you can no longer kind of like exist in this environment anymore because you don't have that, you don't have the tether that was holding you to it. Like how did after this whole experience with Google, how did you then like look at work or what it means to like work within an organization or to have boundaries in different boundaries in a like a work environment?
After Google, I took a job at a company I hated at Facebook, now Meta. And I already knew that I hated it going in, but I was like, you know, I loved Google too much. That was not good for me. And so now I'm just going to try it out with a company I abhor. And I stuck it out for 10 months. And in many ways, it was a useful like reset to be like, okay, I can be an engineer, you know, like to do the job that I had wanted to do. And I had a manager who was like younger than me. He was like 25. And I was like 27. And so he would like be in his Zoom background was like his childhood bedroom with like a full size bed, like shoved into the corner and like black sheets on it. So it was.
Why are black sheets so gross?
Hold on. Like, are we talking his actual background or he had like a photo of his childhood background?
That would be hilarious.
As like a green screen with like a race car bed frame.
Oh my gosh. Sorry, super professional. Nothing says Wonder Boy like a race car bed in the background. But then I quit. I left Facebook after I wrote this piece about work. I got all these messages from people who were like, I loved a job too, and I was burned by it. And then they kind of took like a rebound job that they hated. Mm. And then all these people were telling me, they were like, okay, it is possible to love what you do, or at least not hate it, and have good boundaries. Mm. So that really inspired me to rethink like, okay, why am I here? You know, and I chose software for the money. Really, like I think some parts of it were like are really, really interesting. It taught me a lot. And also like when I was in college, I needed a place to stay. I needed health insurance. And my circumstances changed. Mm-hmm. And that was really hard to come to terms with, and also to like give myself the freedom to be like, okay, I can quit.
Mm. Did you find an experience now that like that after Facebook meets those needs?
Yeah. Well, now I'm writing full time, which is what I like dreamed about doing as a child and teenager. And it's been like, I started doing reporting like more in earnest, and it's honestly like so exciting and terrifying that I can't sleep. Like that's, I'm like in therapy talking about like, I can't sleep at night. I'm like so excited to do stuff the next day.
I hear that.
Yeah. You hear that?
Yeah. I do.
Yeah.
Very much so.
I thought you were being sarcastic.
No. I lay my head down at night and I just think about all the things I'm going to do tomorrow. that's what happens when I put my head down. And then I actually fall asleep about 5 minutes later.
Yeah, yeah. yeah.
For 5 minutes, it's jam-packed.
Yeah,
and it feels like I'm never going to sleep. And then my brain shuts off.
Yeah, it takes me 20 seconds. Emmy, what would you say is the biggest thing that your struggle with mental health has taken away from you?
For me, it's the feeling of everything being all right in the world. I really struggle with not feeling at home in myself or able to like trust other people. Mm. And I think that that's a PTSD, complex PTSD thing. Or we could just say the sleep. Like I have some major issues like waking up in the middle of the night and being awake for hours. Mm. And that can kind of make your whole life like spin on a different axis.
Yeah. Sleep is crazy. If you don't get sleep, that's a major, major impact.
What would you say is the biggest thing that it's given you?
I think I have, seems like such a cliche, but I do think I have more empathy for others than I would have had. Before I went to therapy and I really was honest about what I was going through, I was like only achievement oriented. And I thought, okay, it doesn't matter what someone struggles with, like as long as they achieve enough, it's all for the better. And now I realize that that's really cruel. That's the standard that I was held to sometimes. And that's a horrible, destructive standard. And so now I value my suffering and my experience and other people's suffering a lot more.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious what your experience with therapy is like now as an adult versus what it was like as a kid.
When I first went back to therapy, I had a really bad experience. I was like 25. I was going through this stuff at Google and I had a therapist who I think was just totally out of her depth. And I went in being like, you know, I want to talk about some trauma stuff. And she did not want me to talk about it. You know, she wanted me to wait like 5 or 10 years. Like that's what she would tell me. And it's like, it's shocking in a way, but it's also like, you know, she thought that that was what was going to help me. So I really had to dig into the research around PTSD because that was my main complaint. And I ended up becoming a research subject in an exposure therapy study where you literally just talk through what happened in like extreme detail. Again and again, you have to listen to tape recordings like of yourself talking about it.
Wow.
It was really gnarly and like horrible. But it got me to the place where I was like, okay, now I can like go to a therapist. I can talk about what happened. And for the last 4 years, I've had like the most excellent therapist ever. I'm like, wow, if only everybody had a therapist like her, we would not be talking about like times therapy is harmful when you're not ready to go to therapy. Like she's wonderful.
That's it. I feel a lot like that because I've been really fortunate to have like right from the get-go, a good therapist that I've been with now for the last couple of years. And like, I hear about people's experiences and I understand that can very much happen, but I've been so lucky. I'm like, this is so great. Like, I wish everybody had this. Yeah.
Emmy, this has been a really, really fun conversation. And I would love to give you a moment to just kind of plug anything and everything that you've got going on in your life. How can people find you? How can people find the book? And just how can people in general just stay up to date with the work that you're doing?
My book is called Acceptance and it's from Penguin Press. You can buy it wherever you buy books. And my website is emmyneedfeld.com, just my first name, last name. And I have a newsletter, which is honestly way more fun than social media, where I suggest like trashy recommendations of like all my guilty pleasures. And also when I'm publishing new essays.
Amazing. This has been really, really fun. Thanks for taking time out of your schedule to sit and chat with us.
Thank you so much for having me. You guys are awesome.
Well, there you go, folks. Hope you enjoyed that conversation. As always, we are coming at you Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And if you are a fan of the podcast and you want to support the podcast, there's a number of ways you can do that. First of all, you can leave a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts. We love reading them. You can simply rate the podcast on the Spotify mobile app, if that's where you're listening. Or if you want to join the conversation, hop on over to our Discord. The link is in the show notes of this episode. And we have a lovely little community over there of sickos and non-sickos all hanging out, chatting. And hey, you could even help produce the podcast over there if you want. You can, again, find that link in the show notes below. Sick Boy Podcast is produced and co-hosted by myself, Jeremy Saunders, Taylor McGilvery, and Brian Stever. The show is managed by Jeffrey Lonis over at Talent Bureau. The sound design of this episode is brought to you by Donovan the CPAP Morgan. And of course, the theme music is from the band Take Part. That is it for this week. I'm Jeremy, and this is Sick Boy.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.